Hello and welcome. I am Børge Andreassen, Managing Director of the Executive Search Business at Prospectus. We work in partnership with social impact organizations to find and appoint values-driven leaders to deliver the mission, building inclusive boards and leadership teams. Welcome to our podcast series, where we explore relevant topics and how leaders deliver social impact. Today, we are speaking with Fozia Irfan, Chief Executive of Beds and Luton Community Foundation. Fozia is also a trustee of the Association of Charitable Foundations and Fair for All Finance, and she is an advisor to the National Lottery Community Fund. She is a campaigner and speaker on issues relating to diversity, equity and inclusion, and has particularly engaged around how philanthropy and grant making can become more accountable. Welcome, Fozia. So Fozia, I'm really interested to hear a bit more about your own sort of career transition from being a solicitor, working in the law in sort of a commercial setting and into the charity sector and the foundation sector. I know why did you make the move and how did you experience it?
Well, for me, it wasn't a sudden chop and change, really, because I think it was more of a transition, because I've always been involved in charities as a volunteer right from a young age. So it was part and parcel of my life before I took it on as paid work. When I had my children, I sort of reevaluated my life, and I felt that my quality of life was really important to me, and being a lawyer in those days required blood, sweat, tears, and very, very long hours. And so my family life and my work life just weren't compatible. I think nowadays things have got better. But at that time, it was very difficult to maintain the two. So I took on a volunteer role at the foundation, just building on from my charitable volunteering. And I was a grant panel member, so making decisions about grants. And that was really interesting. And a part-time role came up, and I thought, well, I could do that for a year or two before I go back to the law, because the law is a proper profession, as my parents keep telling me. Mm-hmm. But I just found the foundation world fascinating, intriguing, challenging, and just so much more fulfilling. And I feel that I've got so much more potential to affect change within this sector. Which is quite surprising, given that most people think of, law being where you affect real social change. But there are lots of different methods. And for me, working in the foundation sector is a real privilege. So it was more of a transition rather than a complete change.
And when you sort of stepped into the, let's say, the paid role, so when you became a sort of charity professional, or what you might call it, how did you experience that? Were there any aspect of that that was surprising to you, that was different from what you had expected?
I think I found the pace of work a lot slower. Obviously in a law, in a commercial setting, every 6 minutes was timed as a lawyer. You billed for every 6 minutes. So you were hyper conscious of how you spent your time. Whereas within the charitable sector, I found the pace of work slightly slower. Originally, at the start, I think in the last 3 or 4 years, particularly with the foundation work that we're doing, things have really speeded up. I think what I also found what I was really surprised at, how committed people are in the charitable sector. I mean, nobody is in the charitable sector to make money, let's be honest. It's because they have a passion, they have a drive. And I found, and I do think that that's probably the best part of my job, is working with people who are really working in communities, changing people's lives, doing things on a volunteer basis with very little pay in very challenging circumstances. So actually it restores your faith in humanity, ironically, even though you're dealing with some of the most challenging circumstances that people face.
And that's really interesting what you say about initially there about pace, for example. So it was different. I mean, thinking about that, were the things you took with you from your sort of commercial career, your solicitor career, that that you've really been able to draw on as you came into the charity sector?
Oh, definitely. And even now, I would still recommend law as a career, because the 2 years training that you do as a solicitor, you know, I think it sets you up for any profession. The skills you learn in terms of communication, written skills, negotiation, diplomacy, all of those really important skills, management, leadership. You know, I still credit my legal background for giving me that foundation to do the work that I'm now able to do. So I'm incredibly grateful that I went through that intensive training and picked those skills up.
And as you see, so you started in a part-time role, and then you're now the chief executive of the foundation. Any sort of reflections on that journey for yourself in terms of your career and having moved into that sort of leadership role within a community foundation?
Well, to be honest, it was not a role I'd seen myself in at all. As I said to you, I thought I'd, you know, work as a grants manager for a couple of years and go back into the law. Yeah. And I think originally when, you know, it was sort of being proposed by my board and we were sort of thinking about it, it felt very unnatural to me. I'm not, you know, the classic sort of leader, you know, the vision of a leader that I had at that point was someone male with very macho, sort of assertive qualities, outgoing, you know, those sorts of qualities. And I'm sort of the opposite to that. I'm an introvert. I'm soft-spoken. I work by consensus, you know, all of those qualities. And so I probably spent about 6 months grappling with how I saw myself as a leader. And I and part of the process of that transformation to me, seeing myself as a leader, was my the master's that I did at Cass Business School. And as part of that master's, they also offered executive coaching, which I'd never had before. And so working with an executive coach over 6 months, and she really changed my perceptions of what a leader was and how a leader worked. And so now I think the qualities that I bring, they aren't the traditional qualities that you associate with, but actually in today's world, they're probably more relevant than ever.
And I think that's really interesting, because in the time I've been doing this job, so headhunting and recruiting leaders in the charity sector, I think my experience in terms of what clients ask of us is that the sort of traditional old-fashioned type of CEO, we don't really, of those leadership skills, we don't really get asked for those anymore.
That's interesting.
It is much more the things that you talked about around collaboration, around consensus, I guess bringing people with you.
Exactly.
Which I think in this sector is probably particularly important.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing that I've learned is, you know, the ability to have a vision is great. And anybody can have a vision in terms of what they want for their charity, for their foundation. But it's just hypothetical unless you bring people with you to embrace that vision and to implement that vision. That's actually the hard bit of the job. You know, quite a lot of conversation about being a leader is about setting strategy. And to be honest, and you know, that's important. But really, the hard bit is implementing strategy. It's implementing vision. It's convincing people that, you know, this is the way that we want to do things. Mm. And so all those skills, I think, are really necessary now.
And I think many people that I have talked to who have made a transition that similar to you from sort of hard-nosed commercial world into the charity sector, one of the biggest challenges is that you have to bring people with you. You have to win hearts and minds.
Yeah.
You don't have like the paycheck or the bonus or whatever it is to kind of bring people along. It is, you have to win them over. Yeah, they have to believe in you and what you do.
Exactly. And that's why people are in the charity sector. It's all about hearts and minds. That's why people do what they do. They're so committed to their cause, genuinely, deeply from their hearts. And so you have to be able to you know, bring them with you, convince them that this is something which is good for, you know, the organization, for communities, etc. So yeah, more important than anything.
So you and I know well what community foundations do. you run one, and I recruited for many, but maybe some of the people who listen to this podcast aren't so familiar with the kind of philanthropy that you do in a community foundation. So would you mind just telling us the kind of the elevator pitch of a community foundation?
Well, community foundations actually originally started in the US and developed in Canada, and they have a much longer history, probably about 200 years or so in the US, whereas really they only began to flourish here in the UK in the last 20 to 30 years. And essentially what community foundations do is we are place-based grant makers. But what's unique about us is that we also raise funds. So we raise funds just like any other charity, but our primary business is to make grants to the local community. And what our unique selling point is that we have really close relationships with the communities that we serve. I and my grants managers will know all the groups that we fund. We will have an intimate knowledge of community issues. We will have a very deep relationship with our grantees. I've worked with national foundations where you just have sort of a paper application form. You don't know who the people are. You don't know what work they do, and you make a decision as to whether or not to give a grant. Whereas with community foundations, it's about that connectedness to community, which makes us experts in grant making and also raising funds.
And I can imagine at the moment we're in June 2020, we've had sort of 3 months of national lockdown following COVID-19 and all the impact that's had on communities. Tell us a bit about how you as the foundation have responded to the community in Bedfordshire and Luton as part of this situation and crisis?
Well, I think, to us, immediately it was apparent that our charities were going to suffer greatly. You had the double-edged sword where their income has just completely cut off. There is no income. But at the same time, the demand on their services have increased enormously. So immediately we set about setting up an emergency fund. Mm-hmm. And what we did, which was unusual, is that we contacted all the trusts and foundations in Bedfordshire and said to them, look, it's much better if we work collectively. We as a community foundation will manage the application process. We will just have one form where any charity in Bedfordshire can apply for all of our grants. So this was the first time in Bedfordshire that we had one collective fund. For all trusts and foundations. And that has been, the feedback that we've had from applicants and grantees is that has saved them so much time. So we set that fund up straight away. We set up a process where we were able to start distributing grants within 2 weeks, and we continue to distribute those grants on a weekly basis. So payments were just being paid out week by week. And most of these grants were up to 7,500. So they're not large grants, but they were grants that were so desperately needed. And just by having a very simple application process, very quick turnaround, payments out quickly, we've had a really good response from communities and charities who appreciated the way that we've worked. And at that point, it was all about immediate need. It was about food banks. It was about health for the elderly. It was, that sort of crisis management. Over the last few weeks, now we're sort of looking at the phase two of funding. So now we're talking again to the trusts and foundations and saying, the impact of COVID is going to be very, very far reaching, and especially for our sector, and especially for the charities that we work with, the majority of whom are small grassroots organisations. And getting a grant from us at the moment is a difference between survival or closure. It's really at that sort of point we've reached. So now we're looking at how do we support and rebuild the infrastructure and the charities who we're working with. We're sort of at a midpoint now in terms of what we're funding. We've been funding a lot of things like laptops, mobile phones, technology, which enables charities to deliver their services in a different way. And we foresee that continuing for quite a few months. And then the next, the next 6 months, we'll really be thinking about, supplementing income, preventing closure, and helping charities if they need to restructure or to deliver their services in different ways.
And I can imagine that the charities you fund, the community groups you fund, it's a real lifeline for them. And as you said, you prevent closure. How have you found the sort of collaboration with your foundation colleagues? And has that worked well? Because obviously it is something there's a lot of talk about, more collaboration in the sector and so on. It sounds like that's worked well on this occasion.
On this occasion, it really did. And I don't know whether that's because we already have connections and relationships with the foundations and trusts. Over the last few years, we've tried to work with them in terms of sharing best practice. And we had a loose collective. But because, we're a small county, relatively, everybody kind of knows each other. I don't know if that helps. I've been involved with collaborations in relation to COVID at a national level, and it's much, much harder. So I think the fact that we had pre-existing relationships, we're geographically much smaller, and there was a huge goodwill from the trusts and foundations. And I suppose a lot of trust that they placed in us, that helped. I mean, we've spent 2 years really building our credibility and our visibility as a community foundation. And I think that was part of the process to get to this point where the other trusts and foundations trusted us with their funds and said, okay, you get on with it.
And obviously as a community foundation, you also know your kind of local business community and so on, philanthropists and so on in the area. Has this COVID-19 crisis and situation been able you to sort of further those relationships? How have that side of your community sort of responded to this?
We're still working on that. Our pre-existing corporate donors have been brilliant, and that includes Luton Airport. And mm-hmm. You can imagine the crisis that airports are going on at the moment. But we receive a lot of funding from the airport, which has continued, and they've carried on supporting where they can. In terms of new donors, we haven't actually ventured that far at the moment. I think if we were to contact new corporate donors, it would probably be in a very targeted way in terms of people we already knew or companies we'd had some sort of relationship in the past. I think we have to be quite mindful and sympathetic to what's going on in the business sector at the moment as well. Mm-hmm. But, we're constantly highlighting the work that we do and the fact that if companies do want to contribute, they can contact us and work with us in that way.
And I guess this it's an opportunity for where everybody in a sense, we're not all in the same boat, but we all experience something very unique at the moment. So it can perhaps help bring people together.
Definitely. And I think that, the fact that we've managed to do this on a countywide basis where people are working together, we're seen as the funder that everybody now approaches. We're seen as a key stakeholder, not just in terms of the public sector, but the corporate sector, etc. And I think that's the role that community foundations should play. That, I think for far too long, a lot of us have been very passive grants administrators, whereas I really see our role as community foundations being leaders within the community, leading the conversation, facilitating the conversation, showing the direction. So I'm pleased that we've been able to demonstrate that.
And on that sort of role of philanthropy and leadership, and I'm curious if we could talk a bit about philanthropy and perhaps driving social change at sort of a wider scale. I mean, the last couple of years in particular, there's been a lot of talk about the role of philanthropy in driving or perhaps not social change. And the role foundations and philanthropists have. And I was, you talked a bit about in the past, or quite a lot about decolonizing philanthropy. And as we speak, some of the statues of philanthropists are coming down because of their involvement in slave trade. kind of what are your thoughts on seeing these statues coming down of these people?
I think that, you know, the one thing that has been achieved by these statues coming down is the conversation. Prior to now, prior to this moment, you know, I could count on the fingers of one hand the number of people I'd had a conversation with about slavery and decolonization and colonialism, etc., in the philanthropy sector. Whereas, you know, this very visual representation of all those concepts, I think, has just brought the conversation, you know, to prominence in a way that I've never seen before. And I think in relation to the role of philanthropy in social change, you have such a wide spectrum. You have, you know, foundations who I think are really progressive, like Joseph Rowntree, Barrow Cadbury, who focus on maybe two or three key issues and are interested in advocacy, in policy change, in funding social movements quite explicitly. But they're few and far between. They're the exceptions. I think the majority of foundations, the problem that they have is that there's very little accountability and scrutiny. And without accountability and scrutiny, you know, you don't have to justify where you're spending your funds or how you're spending them or what you're funding or what you're not funding. So without that spotlight shining on foundations, I think there has been a sense of complacency, which I think is being challenged now. I think in the last, even in the last 12 months, you know, you have writers like Rob Reich, you have Edgar Villanova, who really shone a spotlight on foundations and said to everybody, hang on, everyone, look over here. There's something going on here. People are influencing or not influencing social change. They control a lot of wealth and they have no accountability. So I think foundations are becoming aware of that. And it's a really... it's an interesting balance in terms of how far foundations should go in terms of supporting or opposing the status quo. You have, you know, foundations in America which were very explicit, for example, in terms of funding civil rights movements, which on the face of it sounds brilliant. But, you know, research has been done, and I think Megan Ming Francis is a really good writer and has analysed the way that the civil rights movement was funded and actually shown that the way that foundations captured the movement and took it in a different direction was perhaps not the way that movement would have developed itself. But because of funding and what was funded, you know, the civil rights movement went in a certain direction as opposed to a different direction. So we have to be very careful when we're looking at social change that we're not capturing that movement and shaping it into what suits us.
Because what I'm thinking when I hear you talk is what happens then is that the people with the power, with the funds, shape movements to take them in the direction that they're comfortable with. Or that make them feel good. You feel good because you do something good, but actually, you might do it in a way that the community that started the action didn't intend it to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So even with the civil rights movement, you know, originally the focus was on protection of life, and you know, we see the fact that that hasn't been tackled even to today. Protection of life. Whereas what the funders and foundations funded was education. So educational achievement, educational outcomes. That's what they were interested in. That's what suited them. Whereas protection of life in terms of dealing with the criminal justice system, the prison system, in terms of police brutality, that was not funded originally. So you can see the repercussions of that that we're seeing today.
And how, so then, if you sit on the board of a foundation or you're a foundation executive, what are some of the steps you can take to make yourself and your funding more accountable?
I think a lot of it is about the type of foundation you are, unfortunately. There are some foundations who are limited, family foundations in the way that they're set up, etc. But But there are, you know, the majority of foundations do have a lot of freedom to set their own agenda. And I think the one criticism that I would have of the foundation sector is that I don't think we're ambitious enough, and I don't think we're bold enough in setting our vision. And sometimes we just sort of chug along, just doing what we've always done, because that's what we've always done. And actually, you know, the foundations that I studied in the US, who've now evolved to talk really ambitiously about social justice, about racial justice, you know, that's what some foundations in the UK could be doing if they were slightly more courageous, if they were slightly more bold, slightly more ambitious.
And I guess it's talking about sort of justice and racism. Obviously, we are having the Black Lives Matter movement at the moment, kind of really big demonstrations, a lot of focus on these issues. And I feel that debate has shifted a bit because, you know, I've, as a recruiter for so many years, I've talked about diversity and inclusion. And I think that is important. But I think what we're not really talking about is the racism that actually means that we don't have the diversity and inclusion that we're looking for in the first place. So what are the causes of the problems? And I guess, how can we tackle that? Because that is probably a lot harder in some ways than to look at some of the stats and the data and all those sort of things. So that's difficult.
It is. And I think one of the things that I've been talking about a lot in the last few weeks is the fact that diversity, equity and inclusion work is not the same as anti-racism work. They're two separate fields. Anti-racism work is really about confronting white privilege. It's about understanding our biases and structural racism, you know, and talking about racism in a very explicit way, whereas diversity, equity, inclusion is a much broader field of work, you know, which is separate. So I think actually what this is, I hope, has done is made people realise that actually it's not enough just to say I'm not racist, but everyone, every individual, every foundation needs to have a plan to do anti-racism work. And, you know, when I went to Greater Buffalo with the Community Foundation there, and I spoke to the CEO, and they have a very explicit racial equity lens for all their work. And I spoke to her and I said to her, how did you get to this point? How did you move your board to get to this point where they're talking about race explicitly? And she said it took a long time. It took years. And it started with individual members of the board going through a learning process about anti-racism. You know, they had to read books. They had to educate themselves. They had discussions. And only once the board were ready to accept that racism existed, what it looked like, what it meant for people, were they able to implement this racial equity lens in everything that they did. So it has to start with individual anti-racism work.
And at the moment, there's a lot of talk, for example, about, and hopefully some action, but about allies and about kind of the role of white people, white individuals, and white society. And that people need to speak up, and sort of silence is violence, as the slogan is. What are your thoughts on that, and kind of how would you encourage 99% of foundation trustees are white, so how can they become allies and support this?
It's exactly what I said about educating yourself. It's strange, but I have had a lot of requests for reading lists, which and a lot of requests for my time to explain to white people individually what they need to do. And, you know, I say what other people of colour always say is that you need to educate yourself. The resources are out there. There are books out there. There are webinars. There are, workshops. There's all sorts of ways in which you educate yourself. And whilst you're educating yourself, have conversations with people of colour and listen to what people are saying. There have been many conversations where you try and talk about racism or how racism has affected you, and people diminish what you're saying. They'll say, well, it wasn't that bad, was it? Or actually, I'm not quite sure what I see as racist in that conversation, in that interaction. As a person of colour, if I'm saying to you that this interaction was racist and it made me feel in a certain way, don't diminish that, accept it. So there are 1,000 ways that white people can help. I think really understanding white privilege and realising that racism essentially is a problem for white people. It's a problem that people of colour suffer the consequences of, but the place where it resides is with white people. And I'm not saying that exclusively. I mean, obviously, there's racism in many communities, and even within the Asian community, there's so much racism. But if we're talking about the specific context of structural racism, of power within the UK, of all these disparities in outcomes, that are manifested in so many ways, you know, the disproportionate impact of COVID, Black Lives Matter movement, disproportionate number of people of colour in prisons, etc. These are all about structural issues relating to white privilege. And so it's only white people who can really take hold and dismantle those structures.
How I understand it, as a white person, everything is created through my lens.
Yes.
So I'm never challenged in a way on, and I can walk through, we all have different degrees of financial privilege or whatever is important to people, but as a white person you can walk through life without being challenged or looked on differently.
Exactly. And it's there's a phrase that is used in the US, white space, and I've used it sometimes to talk about foundations and the charitable sector in the UK, and I've challenged people to say, well, is the foundation sector white space? Is the charitable sector white space? And by white space, that's a definition that Professor Elijah Anderson came up with, and it's basically any space where people of colour are either not present or they're marginalised or their voice is not heard. Mm-hmm. So if we start referring to these spaces as white space, then you can see how the structures, the interactions, the relationships, the people influence what that space looks like and how it feels to people of colour in that space.
And do you feel sort of in the last year or two, sort of the conversation has shifted? Has it become more honest? Has it changed a bit? Or is it, we still have a lot of work to do, clearly.
I'm hoping that this moment in time is where the shift happens. I think, up until now, people haven't talked about anti-racism work. It's always been about diversity, equity and inclusion, which is important that, there's a whole need for that work. But this is the first time that I'm seeing race, being explicitly mentioned, and some awareness and some conversation. So I'm hoping that this is the critical moment when things do change. With ACF, they've asked me to chair a session on racial equity. 2 years ago, would that be possible? 4 years ago, would that be possible? And they've said that it's one of the most popular webinars that they've ever publicised. There's been such a huge response, they had to upgrade their subscription. So, as ever, I'm always hopeful.
And I guess that's a kind of nice note to sort of start to finish our conversation on. But do you? It sounds like you feel optimistic for the future.
I was lucky enough to meet Darren Walker, the president of Ford Foundation, One of the questions I asked him was, how do you not become demoralised by this work? And he said to me, we are in the business of hope. We are not in the business of despair. And I stand by that. That really appeals to me. I would not be doing this work if I wasn't hopeful. That's what I keep coming back to.
Thank you so much, Fosia. I really appreciate that. It's been a fantastic and really interesting conversation. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thank you for covering this topic in such detail and depth and with such sensitivity. It's a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Fosia, for sharing your insights with us and our community. That's been incredibly interesting, and I appreciate so much you taking the time today. To those who listen in, please feel free to get in touch with Prospectus if you'd like to continue the conversation. And please do look out for our next podcast to be announced soon.